Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation. Good morning, gentlemen.
Shalom.
Morning.
Howdy.
Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. It's really cold outside.
Negative 14 is what it was saying on my phone.
I was positive surprised. 95 in this office.
Yes, we've had the heat on for quite a while, so we don't have to run it during recording. I thought for sure all the local schools were going to cancel, but they're all in just 2-hour delay. So apparently we've become full Midwestern by now, which is good.
Yeah. And what are we drinking?
What do you think of it?
So I don't want to trash coffee on air that I don't know about, but it's like a... Like, what if it was like an Ethiopian that was a little stale? Does that make sense? I don't know. There's something in there that's funky.
Light roast, dark roast.
I think it's mean to be a light. Like, it mean to be a light.
Okay.
I don't know if it is, though. Like a.
It's a light roast.
Okay.
It's an Ethiopian.
Okay. There's something about it. I don't know what to say.
I lost the bag. It's the Red Horn.
Oh, it's the Red Horn?
It is. From Taylor Jarman. And he had his hub on all night in this roasting hot office, and the coffee was sitting on his hub, and I picked it up to make it this morning. The bag was, like, warm.
What do you think of it?
I think it's good. It's okay. Not as bright as some Ethiopians, but it's still very good.
So... I had this exact bag of coffee 2 weeks ago, and it didn't taste this way. I kid you not. I think
maybe
that's
hub
damage.
Maybe you're better at roasting it or something.
But maybe anyway. We should roast my hub.
No, I'm...
Maybe it took some of the flavor out of it.
I think it took some of the power, anyway.
Could be.
There's a... I mean, I can tell it's like blueberry in the background. I can tell it's like... But it feels like it's a little stale. So maybe that's what it was.
Maybe if someone would clean their desk a little more often, this wouldn't happen.
Hey, this is a working desk. That's all I've got to say. I use my office.
You do. All right.
Oh, the kombucha.
And Andy.
Yes.
There's other things here.
We were gifted a bot kombucha from Bethlehem Bakery. That'd be the Nordstroms, who are great friends of the podcast. Well, not guest friends, but they've just given us a lot of kombucha over the years. And it's really good. It's like a coconut gingery kind of thing. I really like it.
Their kombucha is like the one kombucha I like.
Yep. It's the one kombucha Mala likes. I like all the kombuchas, but theirs is really good.
Yeah, theirs is.
But they wanted us to announce their Hobbit Hole, an open Hobbit Hole. So if you guys ever been to an open house, they're doing an open Hobbit Hole. They've done this for years. How many? You've gone to it, Tim, right? Charlie, have you gone to the Hobbit Hole?
I have not.
Okay. We go to it pretty much every year.
Okay. It's really fun. So it starts at 6:30 in the morning, and they have first breakfast at 6:30, second breakfast, 11:00, lunch, afternoon tea, dinner, supper, and after supper rehearsal. And each one of those times someone arrives and brings sort of a dish, and then they have tons of baked goods and things. And you sit down and eat, talk, and then there's a meal. You sing a hymn and pray.
Yep.
And so it's a really great time. And they wanted to open invite, because it's an open invite, anyone who's interested, who's a listener. So if you look for the Open Hobbit Hole online, you can go to that and you'd welcome. And I enjoyed it and I plan on going this year also.
Yeah. What date is it?
February 22nd. Saturday, February 22nd.
Yeah, I think that works for us. So we'll probably be there.
Are costumes allowed?
Yes. Encouraged.
What kind?
Hobbit costumes.
Yes, absolutely. You would actually probably get a prize.
My kids have brought their swords. And there had been sword fights in the front yard of the Nordstrom.
Oh, seriously?
Oh, yes.
If you got a fake beard, though, you could pull off a dwarf.
You know, sword fights with little boys in front of the Nordstrom's house sounds more endearing than college students fighting with lightsabers on the circle.
Some things never change. All right. So are we ready for runway? Is that what's next?
Let's do it.
Oh, no. Listener interaction. There was an email that was sent by Greg Gosnell, and I want to pull it up. And while I do that, Tim, do you have anything you want to say about the bookstore?
What is it that I want to say about the bookstore? I forget.
I don't know. I just was Just a time filler.
Hey, so we are selling Mapping Discipleship like crazy. So pick up a copy. Please don't buy it on Amazon. Buy it from us. We'd prefer that. It would help us. And the copy of the book is not a print-on-demand title. It's prettier.
If we don't sell all 2,000, the communists win.
Okay. Whatever.
Listener, I wish you could see Charlie's face when he said that and then his face. It's... We do a YouTube channel one day. I really do think so.
Yeah. We already have one. We just haven't posted any videos to it. I did just pull it up. So I'm going to read the full email, which this is a book that I have read. So this is from Greg Gosnell, better known as Pastor Goose. And hi, guys. Came across this quote in Path to Being a Pastor by Bobby Jameson. If you guys ever interact, I know, Tim, you've interacted with this a little bit.
A little bit.
So Bobby Jameson was an associate pastor at Capitol Hill with Dever in DC. He recently left and is at a church plant. I don't know where, but so he's one of the nine marks, you know, our authors. And I think he bears a passing resemblance to Paul Rudd. But anyway, so when I see him, I think of like Ant-Man. But so this is on page 103 of Path to Being a Pastor. And I thought it was a really good quote. A good book is the best insurance policy against wasted time.
Oh, that's good. Wow.
Yeah. I like that.
Wow.
And what I'm sad about is that I've read Path to Being a Pastor, and I must have just missed that when I read it. I can't believe I didn't like catch that in the wild on my own.
Yeah, that is a really good quote.
Yeah,
I feel like that needs to be on my door or something. Like that's one of those kind of office-y kind of quotes.
I think what's interesting about all those nine marks guys is I do think Dever really prizes and values like the life of the mind in his ministry. So like a lot of his guys do have some really good thinking, but they're also kind of weird.
I might add to it. I think Emerson has a quotation that says something like a good reader makes a good book. And so if you're just thinking about a book being the best insurance policy against wasted time, there does need to be a thoughtful reader involved, of course. But it's a good quotation nonetheless.
One of the seven laws is that there needs to be an attentive learner.
There you go.
Yeah. Oh, all right. Here's what's in this episode. We're going to do books in business, and I'll start. I'm going to talk very briefly about the main content book, which is The Bridge of San Luis Rey, I believe is how it's properly said. I don't know. Tim's going to talk about My Dear Hemlock. Josh is going to talk about Why Read Moby Dick. And Andy is going to talk about two things. Is Memoria a book?
That's the third of the Nightingale trilogy. So Lumen and Caller. Yep. So that's the third.
I'm Boaz, Leif Unger, I cheerfully refuse.
Oh yeah. I got quotes. They're good.
Yeah. I
have you gotten into it?
We'll talk when you get there. So it's time.
Books and business.
Let's talk about some books. And I'm going to really quickly, in case you don't want to listen to the full discourse of the main content, where I'm going to talk about the book, which I'll say now, there will be spoilers. So if you want to read this on your own and don't want to listen to the content, you want to get the experience before you listen, I'm going to talk about The Bridge of San Luis Rey. Then, really quickly, I do think it's a good book that people should read. I'm going to rank it pretty highly. And it's a fun read, but not fun in like the, well, in the fun way. It's a contemplative book. It's going to cause you to think about things that matter. And in that sense, there's a lot of theological thinking that's a part of it, as we'll get into in the main content and in the final meditation, which I didn't mention in the runway, but you're going to talk about Luke 13.
Yep. I've got a whole thing on it.
I will say now that that passage was the inspiration of this book.
I am so intrigued by that.
So now in that passage, Jesus references a tower that falls and kills 18 people. And he poses the question, was it those 18 because they were more wicked than the others? And so you'll talk about that in the final meditation. That's what happens in this book. A bridge falls and five people die. And the whole book is, well, why those five? And so you have to think about them and you get to learn about the characters that died on the bridge. And some of them make you think, yeah, they probably should have died. But then Wilder, the author, stirs your compassion for them. And you think, well, maybe they didn't deserve to die. Maybe that was grace or mercy taking them home. And so it's very contemplative about life and death and how we interact with that here. And so, yeah, The Bridge of San Luis Rey, it is a short, it packs a good punch. It's a good book. So you should carry it in the bookstore. It'd be a good title to
all right over there. So what are you going to recommendation?
Are you going to wait till your content?
I'll say now, I rank it a 6. So I don't think it's like 7, 8, 9, 10, where it's like everybody needs to own it. Everybody needs to read it multiple times a year. I think it's like upper echelon.
Gotcha.
But it's also not low tier. It's
okay.
It's higher than mid.
When you said I'm going to rank it pretty high, I was expecting the upper tier, but now I get it. I get what you're saying.
It's not like
that
I wouldn't
great.
Put it in the stratosphere of like a Postman.
Okay.
But it's close.
Okay.
And maybe I'm toying with buying a Wilder biography. And I think maybe like if I learn a little bit more about him and if I can know for sure what his intent was and what he was aiming at, like if I know he's Orthodox and he's thinking about it the same way I am, that might elevate it to a 7. But I'm just also don't think he's trying to make a theological statement. He's writing a fiction novella. So like it's just, you know, he I don't think he wants to be like, here's what I believe, and now this is an allegory. Like, I don't think that's what he wants. I think he wants to write a nice story and for you to think about the characters, and that he does really well. So, yeah. I toyed with like a 6.8, but we don't need to do decimals.
Hey, we should popularize re-ranking books when we read them a second time and just totally giving it a new rank in the second time. And so then if you go back and read that, you could be like adjusting it. Because I wonder if that is a good picture of how reading develops over time. Anyways. Yeah,
I will say I did read it twice.
Oh, there you go.
And I can't remember if I said this on air to Josh, but when I was like 2 chapters in on the first read a few weeks ago, I had no clue what I was looking at. And then I read through and you get to the end and you start thinking about everything. And you're like, oh, wait, was he really doing that the whole time? And you go back and you reread it and you're like, oh, he was doing that the whole time.
Interesting.
But yeah, it's the first book in a very long time I was compelled to reread instantly after finishing. So maybe it is a 7.
I'm totally persuaded by this. Yeah. I think I would put that on my to read list.
We should maybe read Our Town and discuss Our Town, his, famous play.
Yeah, that... most of the interaction with, we don't need to get into this. Most of the interaction with Wilder, if you Google him, it's going to be articles about Our Town or this book. He has other stuff, but none of it was of any acclaim, or mostly.
So the book I'm talking about is My Dear Hemlock, a Christian living book for women, a guard against vices, grow in virtue. That's it. So in this, this is essentially the Screwtape Letters for a woman. So you have Madame Hoxrot, and she is instructing the lesser demon, Hemlock, on how to trip up and to deceive her patient, her client, the young woman. And so my wife, she read through this entire book. She gave even a video. She doesn't normally do this, but she did like a video review of it on Facebook. And I have a little quote here that she... wrote, and I'm going to just kind of read through this one quote from the book from chapter 14, Raising a Strong Woman. Of course, you know, we think of the strong woman. I don't know what you think of. I think of the Proverbs 31 woman.
You do?
And so when we think of a strong woman culturally,
you the OT guy think of that?
A lot of times a strong woman would be like a feminist, you know, somebody who's strong.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So I think that the author is kind of playing on those two ideas when it says on a strong woman. And then it reads, My dear Hemlock, the resolve that comes from bitterness is never a dangerous form of resolve. It will never lead her, the patient, to do anything threatening to our kind. Rather, it is a seat of absolute resistance to the will of the enemy, God, and it will manifest in a variety of lines drawn in the sand of her life. Thus I will do, and no more, she will say. Here I will go, and no further. So there's like a hardness that's taking place. So now here's some quotes that she's encouraging the patient to have. My husband has failed to love me well. Never again will I willingly go to bed with him. Never will I stop doing what's best for my mental health, which could easily be made to include overspending on self-care, dumping her husband, abandoning her parents to the nursing home and her child to the state, etc. Never will I get a job to help with finances, no matter what my husband asks. Never again will I walk through the doors of a church. Never will I forgive my father, my boss, my sister, etc. Never will I stop grieving my lost child, job, home, spouse, childhood, youth, etc. She is capable of harboring the steel pill of resolve into infinity, literally. It is her attempt to eradicate future pain to demonstrate to the enemy that she isn't going to be taken in again. So as you think through that quote and how that corresponds to strength, okay, she's presumably strong against the trials of this world, but in a worldly kind of a way, like a feminist kind of way.
Like strength turned in on self.
Yes.
Rather strength. Than strength relying on the Lord.
On the Lord. That's exactly it. So, and that was a quote that my wife kind of, that my wife shared, and it gives you a little bit of a flavor for the book. We've been selling a lot of this book in the Faith Bookstore. It is on our new title shelf, so it's 25% off, and I'd recommend our listeners picking up a copy and giving it a read. I think it can be a fun read, but also convicting and spiritually nourishing. So, My Dear Hemlock by Tilly,
Fun in a fun way or fun in a non-fun way?
Well, it's like it's like intriguing, thought-provoking, this whole screw
words
tape.
Are hard.
Yeah, Dillahay is the last name.
Thank you.
I don't know them well, but they were friends of our church when we lived in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Their church was friends with our church, sister churches, kind of. The book I have today is Why Read Moby Dick by Nathaniel Philbrick. If you're familiar with Philbrick, he writes popular history. He's written a book on the whaling ship, the Essex, and that's the kind of the basis for the Pequod, which is the whaling ship in Moby Dick. He's also written a book on the Mayflower. I really enjoy his material. I haven't read a lot of his material, but it's that kind of history that is just really engaging to read. And his work as a historian comes through in this short little book. And it's not what I expected it would be. You know, the title, Why Read Moby Dick? That's a question that many people perhaps have. Interestingly, a few episodes ago, I reviewed Andy Nasselli's book, and in the back of that book, he has a list of 40 books that he recommends. And before he gets to his list, he encourages readers to just be okay with not every single book that people recommend being one to your liking. And the one that he mentions is Moby Dick. He says, you know, he read it because R.C. Sproul said this is the greatest American novel. And he says that he kept on waiting for the payoff and it never arrived. But I
didn't think it was that great.
Okay. I disagree with Tim, and I disagree with Andy Nasselli. It's a fabulous, fabulous book. But
so here's the quote of the podcast. Josh agrees with R.C. Sproul. Completely out of context. You can just cut that and put it wherever you want.
I listened to the unabridged version, and we skipped significant portions of it. It's long.
Yeah, if you're a reader that likes a fast-moving plot, it's not going to be for you. And that's what Nasselli says he is. He likes a book that has some pace to it, a plot that has some pace to it. It is not that. Here's what, I'm going to read a couple of quotations from this book. But I will say, so if you pick this up, I was expecting him to kind of make some sort of apology for reading Moby Dick. Like, this is reason number one, you should read this novel. This is reason number two. He does not do that. What you get is simply a man who loves Moby Dick and who writes about interesting things. He looks at a lot of Melville's letters, tries to contextualize what's going on, but it's just there's an infectious admiration for this novel that comes through on every page, and it just makes it fascinating to read. And so it's not maybe what you expect when you get into it. He does answer that question in the final line of the book, but I'll let you read that for yourself if you wish. I would say if you maybe don't have time to read Moby Dick, but are interested in its contents, this would be a helpful book. He does go through major episodes in the novel, gives a sense of its trajectory in terms of plot and those kinds of things.
Do you have like a, Do you recommend the unabridged or an abridged? Or
I suppose it depends on who's reading. Maybe for younger readers, an abridged version would be fine, because one of the compelling features of the novel is this character Ahab, and he's one of the great, interesting, villainous figures in American literature. And you would get that in an abridged version. You would see his kind of the plot related to Ahab and the pursuit of the white whale. However, in the unabridged, that tension builds much more. You don't get to Ahab until chapter 28. That's your first glimpse of this guy. So you're more than 100 pages in before you even see Captain Ahab, and you're waiting for it and waiting for it. But let me just read a couple passages and then we'll pass it over to Andy. But he's talking about this fact that it's a great novel that most people know about, but nobody wants to read, because he said it's too long and too maddeningly digressive. But he says, but the novel, like all great works of art, grows on you. Instead of being a page-turner, the book is a repository not only of American history and culture, but also of the essentials of Western literature. It has a voice that is one of the most nuanced in all of literature. At once confiding, funny, and oracular, an outpouring of irrepressible eloquence that soars into the stratosphere even as it remains rooted to the ground. The book is so encyclopedic and detailed that space aliens could use it to recreate the whale fishery as it once existed on the planet Earth in the middle of the 19th century.
Yeah, that was one of the things I didn't expect, and that it's like a history of whaling. So with reading the unabridged Moby Dick, you're not just getting a story, you're getting a history of whaling.
Right. And sometimes Melville is kind of parodying some of the history of whaling as well, and kind of slightly gently mocking it also, which is funny. But the narrator is fascinating. Ishmael is a fascinating character. He's hilarious, but deep as well. The other quotation, this gives you a sense of the way Philbrick writes, and I just love this description of the novel. He writes, "For me, Moby Dick is like the Oldsmobile my grandparents owned in the 1970s. A big boat of a sedan with loosey-goosey power steering that required constant back and forth with the wheel to keep the car pointed down the highway. Melville's novel is that wandering, oversized automobile, each non sequitur of a chapter requiring its own course correction as the narrative follows the erratic whims of Melville's imagination toward the Pacific. The sheer momentum of the novel is a wonder to behold, barreling along in spite of all the divergences toward the white whale."
Yes, that is like such a great analogy. It's like, why in the world are we going through all of the different sailors explaining their propensities and depravity and whatever else? And he's like a huge chapter talking about the sailors. And I'm like, okay, we're done. And I skipped it. I'm like, we're done. Well, some of them, I mean, they're sailors, so they're not exactly very moral. And I was listening to it with my kids. So,
oh, that's funny. That's a very genuine response from Tim right there. Like, nah, I'm done. I'm done with this. I remember when you read that, there is an episode where you talk about it years ago.
Yeah.
And you're like, this guy's like sleeping in a bed with another guy. And like, what's going on here? And
they were cold.
I remember I haven't read it, but I remember thinking, oh, Tim's reading this. I can't wait to hear this. It's a classic. And then Tim's review was like, I don't know. And it was the Oldsmobile quote. I didn't read it, but man, that is great. That is so good.
Is there a little bit of the car analogy there that, while a little wonky, it's a very reliable, like, it's got so many of the fundamental aspects of American literature. Is that a part of his illustration?
That's not a part of his illustration explicitly, but probably implicitly it is. I mean, you think about those Oldsmobiles, they're good cars, and they're, you know, they're nice, and a certain kind of person drives one. And
they last for a very long time.
Yeah. I'm going to be reading this with my American literature students. We're starting it this week, so perhaps I'll come back at another point and give a little bit of a review to challenge Tim's.
I love it. You do that. I think it would have helped me if I knew that it was also a history of whaling in advance. I was expecting a story, and then here we have a chapter talking about the color white. And it's just like all about the idiosyncrasies of the ominous nature and the character of the color white.
But it is a story, Tim.
Yeah, it's like one of those non sequiturs that's just, okay, there goes that.
I've never read it. It's on the list. It was a book that my uncle, it'd be my mom's twin brother, he owned it. And he had like the really nice leather bound copies. I actually have from his library. This is an egregious foul, but
I can't wait to hear this.
When I was a young boy,
an egregious foul.
His name was Mike, and he had no kids. But so his twins' kids were kind of like, I think we got spoiled a little bit. And he was a very intellectually minded person. He was an FBI agent. If you like pull up some episodes of FBI Files, there's videos of him like solving crimes.
Oh, wow.
Very intelligent. But I didn't know this about him. And he is where, like, when he passed away, they were trying to get rid of some of his things, and they had a random stack of stuff on his table. And I looked and I was like, Silmarillion, what's that? And then, who's Tom Bombadil? And like, so my copy of The Adventures of Tom Bombadil was his. And so he had just this fascinating backdrop of a mind that I never got to really interact with. But when I was a kid, I had saw The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn on his library sitting next to like all these great classics. And I borrowed that. And then just neglected to give it back. And at some point he was like, Charlie, just keep it. So that is still at my parents' house, that single copy of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
Egregious foul.
But so, yeah, but he liked Moby Dick. And at one point he was trying to talk to me about it. And I was, you know, an 8-year-old boy, just had no place in the world for that. So anyway.
All right. I don't know if J.J. Fisher, the author of the Nightingale Trilogy, listens to this podcast. But if she does, took me the third book and you've won me over.
I'm not sure if you saw, but there was a review.
I saw that, yeah.
So that J.J. Fisher is just, ironically, another person named J.J. Fisher.
Yes. And if I'm just saying, the first book, I don't think I understood it. And there was the weird romance, which I don't know how really strong the romance was. I've been thinking back. I listened to The Hunger Games back in the day. And there's quite a bit of romance in those. Apparently that didn't have a problem with that. So I don't think it's pronounced as I thought in the first book. I really think it's the weirdo lady with the weird voice who narrates. And so in the second book, it got really good, really interesting. But the third book is just taken off, and I'm sold. So I'm sold. It's good. I have nothing to say about it, but there's some really intriguing stuff. There's some interesting imagery. So I'm in the middle of Moria. I think I'm over halfway. It's good. The other update I have is I Cheerfully Refuse by Leif Unger is really good. I'm almost halfway. And I would say that I'm not going to say anything about the plot because I don't know what to say. But I will say that what I've really enjoyed, he has an unique style. And I don't know what it was like in the book you read, but it's like stop, start, minimalistic. And yet it does a lot with sentences. So I'll read a couple of samplings. He's commenting on sailing. His wife, Lark, her name, she is into sailing, and they're going to go on this sailing trip. And he said, "We sat on low stools under time-darkened timbers, and steam from our cups of coffee rose curling in the sunbeam. I had sailed once with Lark years ago. It sealed us forever, that trip, and also made the sea a thing I loved best at a distance. But safe ashore, who is immune to the warmth of rubbed teak, a gimbed bronze lantern, coffee steam rising in the sunlight? I admired Eric. I liked his stories. It felt nice to imagine that I too wanted a sailboat. I didn't really. I wanted the twisting steam." And I just thought that was a very evoked a lot of me. He had a really good sentence here. He's sailing and he's going into some haze. And he says, he's sailing for the first time with his wife. And he says, "For half a day, it was as before. Then it changed. I saw it first in the set of Lark's face." Now, Lark's an accomplished sailor, and this is his first time. "She had the tiller and sometimes had me steer while she checked a chart against a compass and horizon and the distant hills of Ontario in the haze. The haze started getting to me. It was waiting for something, or something was in it, waiting." And I just thought that was a good little bit of writing. And the last thing I'll say is, I don't know if I could prove this. There was one time he said a phrase, and it's in here somewhere. And I thought the only place I have ever heard that phrase is in a C.S. Lewis book. And then he says this. He's talking and he says, "The channel is easy to see," said Lark. "It's all right if you know the way," the lady sipped from a mug. Now that we were here, she looked less bemused and more, if I may, affectionate. How do you do? Or how do you do? And where have you come from? She inquired, just as if she were a Narnian or a whimsical rabbit drawn in a pencil. And I thought, is Ransom Lewis? I mean, or is he just as Narnian something else? So, really interesting book. I'm enjoying it. Not what I thought, but I will give you an update eventually. But thank you, sir. It's been a fun read.
Yeah. So all of his books kind of have that similar style flow to them. So, but yeah, I made it like a chapter in, and then it just got buried in a stack of other things on my coffee table. And so it's there. Maybe it'll be one of the books I try to finish at some point this year, but
it's been fun.
Yeah. All right. Let's have a conversation about Thornton Wilder's book, The Bridge of San Luis Rey. I'll just say as well, this is Vintage Classics. They have a really nice look to them.
That is a nice cover.
There's a
I like
whole
that
series
a lot.
Of them.
Yeah.
And I will say, Tim, you're not going to like me when I tell you this comment. So when Close Reads gave out their list, I went to Goldberry Books and I put all of those books in the cart there. And then I went to Amazon and I put all of the same exact editions into a cart there. And it was almost exactly the same, but it's like the difference in like when you get your books is like, it's like, oh, I can have these tomorrow versus maybe in 3 weeks. And that was like, oh man, that's so
all
convenient.
Good, friend.
But I fed the Amazon monster.
Their distribution is what's really amazing. I really do think that's how they've got a lot of customers.
Yeah. But anyway, so to give a tip of the cap to Close Reads, that's where I found this book, that they're reading it. They've actually published a couple of episodes on their podcast about it. And so that would be worth your time if you really like today's discussion. If you read this, their interaction would be good too. And the author is Thornton Wilder. I think I mentioned this last week. He's the only author to win a Pulitzer Prize for both fiction and drama. Only author to ever do that. So this book would be considered a staple of the last 100 years of American literature. It'd be on that list of, you know, if there's a top 50 books written, you know, this is squarely on there. I'm going to start with positives and negatives. So what I really found positive about, I'll start with the negative. It's going to talk in some spiritual terms. It's going to force you to think about spiritual and theological things. And the only real negative I could draw is that it just lacks precision in its point. And I think I might find more clarity in that the more I study of the author and maybe read about the book. There is a lot of subsidiary helps on Wilder. So if you Google him, there's articles, there's a foundation that, with his name where they try to answer questions about this book and things like that.
Just one quick comment about that, not to take time, but I think I heard once somebody say something about literature is excellent at presenting the problem or making us aware of the problem, but literature is not suited to answer the problem. And so you always want to look to your Bible and to theology to find answers, but literature is not necessarily trying to provide that answer for you. It's trying to, it's a yep. beginning place.
So it's so, like the general revelation version.
Yeah. Now, if you'll notice on the document that we're all looking at, lots of asterisks, hold on to that thought for later. Josh, you might've just taken the last bit of the podcast out of my mouth there. So
mea culpa.
Josh is going to be crying in a moment here.
So we'll come back to that negative where I think it lacks precision. That would be, as a very theologically minded person, my only major critique is you're going to talk about life and death and important things. It'd be really helpful to know from what position you're doing that talk. Hold on to that. You know, a nice tip when you're speaking with kids, you hand them something at the beginning. You say, hold on to that. We're going to come back to it later. Like a physical thing. And then at the end of it, you go, okay, are you still holding on to that thing? I'm like, oh, yeah, you told me. I'm like, now we're going to talk about that. So like you hand them a little thing to fidget with for the whole sermon. It keeps them engaged. Anyway.
Charlie just called us kids. He intellectually handed
us
something.
No, I'm not handing you things. But yeah. Anyway, so positives. The two words I would use to describe the book is compelling and contemplative. What's so compelling about it is the characters, they draw you in, and I don't think you really know how it's drawing you in, but you find yourself drawn to these characters, even though they're from very different walks of life. And we'll get into them in a moment, but the first chapter, that character meant almost nothing to me as I was reading about it. And I was like, what is this? What is this? And then it was the second one, shocker, it's a young man. And I found a little bit more commonplace with that character. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I went back and reread it, and kind of with the lens I think I was supposed to have, that first chapter, like, oh, and then that character becomes more ingratiated to me. But so the characters draw you in. As far as writing, there are some passages, like the wisp of the, you know, the steam.
The wisp of the coffee.
Mm-hmm. That you were reading in Unger. There are some passages like that. It takes place in Lima, Peru. And so there's times where he's talking about the mountains and the sea and the clouds and just the scenery. And so there is a little bit of a rustic beauty to the writing, which is, that compels you. There's lines that where he's describing the thoughts and the feelings of some of his characters. And I had to kind of double take at them. Like, ooh, that wasn't interesting. And I don't have any of those pinned to read, but there are moments like that where I think it is strikingly beautiful writing. As far as the contemplation, the content is distinctly theological. It focuses on life and death and the meaning of it. But he is not really theological, so maybe spiritual is a better word. I'm not exactly sure how to pinpoint that. Another positive, it's short. 117 pages, and it's light in the sense that you could progress quickly.
In contrast to Moby Dick.
Yeah, this is not the station wagon of the books.
What kind of a car is it?
I don't know. I can't come up with anything. I don't know.
Do you want to contemplate death and its meaning for 117 pages or 650 pages?
Well, I get the sense that if you read Moby Dick, you're really contemplating. So that last bullet there, I think there's a lot of bang for your buck here. I do think it's a book that if you get into it, you will reread it, as opposed to maybe like a Moby Dick where there's some apprehension to trying it again. Like, I'm reading Brothers Karamazov right now, and I know when I get it done, it's like, man, I'm not going to... Like, it's going to take a lot great. To get me to reread this 800, 900 page giant. This one, I reread it like a day later. I was like, man, I think in one sitting, just blitz through it.
So if you're like wanting to get started on a lit book, this could be a good one for you to like begin with.
Now, that being said, it is not a, I wouldn't say it's a book for every person at every time, because it is going to focus on death. And why things happen and why suffering happens. And so I don't know how helpful it is for all people at all times, but I do think it's really worth it. So just to get into the plot a little bit, the title of the book talks about a bridge. Some might say it's the Bridge of San Luis Rey is the bridge that he's talking about. That's the plot. It's all about this bridge. And it's in Lima, Peru. It's a really old bridge. It was built many, many years ago. And then one day it collapses and five people die. Okay. And I think I highlighted some stuff to read here. And this sparks, when this bridge breaks, it sparks this kind of revival, but it's not really a revival. So the bridge seemed to be among the things that last forever. It was unthinkable that it should break. The moment a Peruvian heard of the accident, he signed himself and made a mental calculation as to how recently he had crossed by it. And how soon he had intended crossing by again. So they're like, oh man, that could have been me. They're like all thinking about I could have died. Yet, and this is the next paragraph, it was rather strange that this event should have so impressed the LeMans, for in that country, those catastrophes, which lawyers shockingly call, quote, the acts of God, were more than usually frequent. That is why it was so surprising that the Peruvians should have been especially touched by the rent in the Bridge of San Luis Rey. Everyone was deeply impressed, but only one person did anything about it. So the bridge breaks, and they're all like, oh man, that could have been me. It's like this whole town is thinking about, what if that was me who died on that bridge? And so that's the plot twist, or the spoiler. Every chapter ends exactly the same way. Let's talk about this person. Let's talk about this person. Let's talk about this person. They die. Let's talk about another person. Let's talk about another person. Let's talk about another person. Oh, they died too. And let's talk about another person. And guess what's going to happen to this person? Let's talk about them for a while.
They're going
to
die.
Oh, they died. So that's the whole plot. That's chapters 2, 3, and 4. Now, kind of getting into how the story unfolds, you have to talk about the characters. So there is a narrator, and he's kind of discussing and walking you through the scenario through the lens of another person. So there's this Franciscan missionary, Brother Juniper, who just happened to be in Lima at the time of this. And there's a really beautiful paragraph where he's like standing out in the countryside and he's thinking about life and he's contemplating this beautiful poetry he's read. And then he glances over and he watches the bridge collapse. And it moves him just like it moves all the other people. Now, the narrator is like recapping to you what happened in Brother Juniper's life as Brother Juniper wants to then study and discuss these five people that died. So what does Brother Juniper do? He decides to, and this is a direct quote from the book, justify the ways of God to men. He wants to scientifically, empirically prove why these were the five people that died. And so he undertakes this great study of who these people are. Were they good people? Were they useful people? Were they pious people? Terms that will come up later. And he's putting this massive tome together of why it was these five. So that's what he's doing. And I'm gonna read some. So that quote I just finished with, everyone was deeply impressed, but only one person did anything about it. And that was Brother Juniper. Anyone else would have said to himself with secret joy, within 10 minutes myself, but it was another thought that visited Brother Juniper. Why did this happen to those five? So everyone else is like, oh man, if it was 10 minutes later, I would have been the one that died. He's the only one that's, well, why those five? Why did this happen to those five? If there were any plan in the universe at all, if there were any pattern in human life, surely it could be discovered mysteriously latent in those lives so suddenly cut off. Either we live by accident and die by accident, or we live by plan and die by plan. And on that instant, Brother Juniper made the resolve to inquire into the secret lives of those five persons, that moment falling through the air, and to surprise the reason of their taking off. It seemed to Brother Juniper that it was high time for theology to take its place among the exact sciences, and he had long intended putting it there. Going on to the next page. But this collapse of the bridge of San Luis Rey was a sheer act of God. It afforded a perfect laboratory. Here at last, one could surprise his intentions in a pure state. So surprise there is not like a, oh, shock. Like, it's kind of like a discovery. So like they could discover his God's, it's capital H, God's intentions. So Brother Juniper wants to prove to man why God's doing what he's doing. He sees the bridge as the perfect opportunity to surprise, to learn the intentions of God and why these five people die. So that's kind of how you set the stage, is this guy's trying to learn why these five people die. He's setting out to do that. Chapter 2, 3, and 4 are kind of reflections on Brother Juniper's work. It's not directly from him, but of the people that die. So just a quick walkthrough of these characters. Chapter 2 talks about, I'm going to call her the Marquesa. And she is a mom who idolatrously loves her daughter. She's a very controlling, kind of odd person. She's comically made fun of at the theater. Everyone kind of knows that she's kind of crazy. And so someone that's not a person that you really would want to be around. So much so that her daughter moves away to Spain. And because she doesn't want to be around her mom. And so her mom, out of her idolatrous attempts to garner attention from her daughter, writes tons of beautiful letters that eventually become famous, and they use them to teach language to little boys. She, as part of her kind of crazy life, she wanted a servant. And so the abbey gives her like an orphan girl to like serve her. And that girl's name is Pepita, And she's actually one of the people that dies falling on the bridge as well. So the Marquesa's there. And then here's this innocent, like, orphan girl who's serving her, who also dies. Esteban is in chapter 3. He's a twin brother who is essentially mute. He and his brother have a twinly bond that involves a sort of mind reading. They have like an ESP with each other, as well as they have an invented language between the two of them. They do a lot of odd jobs, but one of the odd jobs they take up is copying manuscripts at the theater. And while doing that, Manuel, Esteban's twin brother, becomes a letter writing scribe for, and I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly. I don't know if it's meant to be like a Spanish inflection or if it's like a French term. I couldn't exactly track it down. I think it's perichole, which is like lowly dog or a street performer. So it's like this actress theater woman. So it's a kind of another person of ill repute. She wants him to kind of write letters to the men or man that she's having an affair with. And she doesn't want anybody to know about it. And so she gets this mute twin to do all of her writing. And Manuel falls in love with her. She's a star at the theater in the town. Manuel falls in love with her, even though she's like involved in all these trysts with other men, one of which is the Viceroy of Spain, I believe, if I'm tracking characters right. Once this kind of new love enters Manuel, it strains the brother's relationship. So Esteban knows that his brother has this new love in his life. He can sense it. He knows it, and he's jealous about it. Manuel is really conflicted because he loves this woman, and I think it's more of like a passionate love, but she does not love him at all. She's just using him. So that there's like this conflict of the brothers and their relationship. They have this big kind of fight about it. And then eventually Manuel's like, I'm going to give her up. But Esteban feels really guilty about it. Manuel gets hurt. He dies of infection. And that really affects his brother. Esteban is really despairing over the death of his brother. And so there's multiple people trying to help him. They eventually get him connected with this Captain Alvarado, who also lost a daughter tragically. So they kind of bond over that. But right before they're supposed to leave, Esteban tries to kill himself. The captain actually catches him in the act and saves him, convinces him to go on the journey with him. And then right after being convinced to go on the journey, Esteban falls on the bridge and dies. So,
wow.
Seemingly, in the sense of the narrative, right after attempting to kill himself, he is killed. So then chapter 4, you have Uncle Pio. This guy feels like a con man and a grifter, smooth talker, always wheeling and dealing. Most notably, he's the one who discovers the Perichole, that young girl that becomes the theater, famous theater girl. He's the one that gets her into all the taverns and inns and like builds her career. As she becomes famous, their relationship strains, but it was always pretty odd and off. So it's like they're not physically intimate in any way. Some people think that he's her father. Some people think that he's like her manager, but it's like this weird attraction, weird, odd kind of, you kind of get the sense of what I'm going for there. Like, it's not a love affair, but it feels like it is. She hates it. He's very manipulative of her to get her to do the things that he wants. She, as mentioned earlier, she's having these affairs with the Viceroy. She has kids out of wedlock. As kind of in the orbit of the Viceroy, I think she gets a taste of higher society life. So she decides with children to get out of the theater life and try to become a lady of some dignity. So she moves out into the country, gives up the theater. Uncle Pio is like devastated over this. Like, he's losing the one that he's invested in, loves, like, you know, the other two, kind of idolatrously. He's trying to convince her to come back. She won't do it. Then one of her children, which I don't know if I pronounce this correctly, but I'm going to go with Jaime. He's epileptic. There's illness going through their family. He's kind of living out there in the country. He's not being educated. And he finally convinces this mom to let him take the son for a year and educate him in the town. And then they start walking back into town and they fall on the bridge. So both the the boy and Uncle Pio both die on the bridge. As you read through the story, there's things that you notice about all of these characters, and they follow a very similar cycle. They're all seeking love, but a different kind with a slightly different motive. So between the mom, the skeevy, like, grifter uncle guy, the, you know, Pepita, who's like the young girl, Jaime, the young boy, or then the middle-aged man, you know, middle-aged brother. They're all seeking love in a slightly different way with a different motive. The people that they're seeking love from do not initially pay it back in any way. Like, there's a lot of jealousy, bitterness, removal from the main characters that die. They all reach a climactic decision or moment of self-discovery. So with the Marquesa, there's this like resolve to be a better person, to not be idolatrous anymore. Esteban, like, he attempts suicide and then kind of comes to resolve, like, no, I want to live. I'm going to go on this journey. And he dies. And then Uncle Pio, he's like, I'm going to do something good. I'm going to educate this young boy. And then they die. So they all kind of have this moment, like, discovery, like, they're going to change. There's, like, maybe you could call it repentance. And then they're all taken. And so then at the very end, you come back to Brother Juniper. So you've heard these stories, all these three people die. And then there's reflections on Brother Juniper again at the very end. And so I'm just going to try and capture a little bit of how the book ends. It's talking about Brother Juniper's kind of plan, like his study, and he's tried this in other places. So there's this other little village that has some pestilence, and it's talking about his figuring out why people died. It was by dint of hearing a great many such sneers at faith that Brother Juniper became convinced that the world's time had come for proof, tabulated proof of the conviction that was so bright and exciting within him. When the pestilence visited his dear village of Puerto and carried off a large number of peasants, he secretly drew up a diagram of the characteristics of 15 victims and 15 survivors. Each soul was rated upon a basis of 10 as regards to their goodness, their diligence in religious observance, or piety, and its importance to its family group, or usefulness. Here is a fragment of this ambitious chart, and there's names with those three columns, and we mentioned it last week, but there's ratings that he's coming to scientifically, like, how good was this person that died, or how useful was this person that lived? So the thing was more difficult than he had foreseen. Almost every soul in a difficult frontier community turned out to be indispensable economically, and the third column was all but useless, which the third column was usefulness, which I think that's a really good turn of phrase.
That's a good little bit of writing.
The examiner was driven to use of a minus term when he confronted the personal character of Alfonso V, who was not, like Vera N, merely bad. He was a propagandist for badness and not merely avoided church but led others to avoid it. Vera N was indeed bad, but she was a model worshiper and the mainstay of a full hut. From all this saddening data, Brother Juniper contrived an index for each peasant. He added up the total for victims and compared it with the total for survivors, to discover that the dead were 5 times more worth saving. It almost looked as though the pestilence had been directed against the really valuable people in the village of Puerto. And on that afternoon, Brother Juniper took a long walk along the edge of the Pacific. He tore up his findings and cast them into the waves. He gazed for an hour upon the great clouds of pearl that hang forever upon the horizon of that sea, and extracted from their beauty a resignation that he did not permit his reason to examine. The discrepancy between faith and facts is greater than is generally assumed. So he's studying why people live and why people die, and he thinks he can figure it out. And in this instance, what does he come to the conclusion? Like, this doesn't make any sense at all. It's like, it's a mystery. So give a couple more. I think we might just jump and go right to the end here. So what ends up happening is the daughter, who hates her mother when she dies, comes back. The abbess who sent Pepita, that young girl, to work with the Marquesa, she's at the abbey and the daughter comes there. The Pericole, when Uncle Pio and her son die, she comes. And so there's all these people left behind then reflecting about their lives and what do we do now? And it's the abbess kind of walking through and showing all these, you know, people who need help, you know, handicapped or poor people who need help. And so they're like, kind of the moral of it is like, well, you can't do anything for the dead, but you need to serve the people that are here. You need to love the living. And here's the very last page of the book. They're all kind of talking about this, those three characters. So the theater girl, the mom, and then the abbess are all talking about these people that died. And but even while she was talking, this is the abbess, other thoughts were passing in the back of her mind. Even now, she thought, almost no one remembers Esteban and Pepita but myself. Camila, which is the theater girl, alone remembers her Uncle Pio and her son, this woman, her mother. But soon we shall die, and all memory of those five will have left the earth, and we ourselves shall be loved for a while and forgotten. But the love will have been enough. All those impulses of love return to the love that made them. Even memory is not necessary for love. There is a land of the living and a land of the dead, and the bridge is love, the only survival, the only meaning. So the last line of the book talks about a bridge, so it's probably a pretty important thing. The kind of the end of the book is like, you can't justify why certain people died and why certain people lived if you try to do it, which, by the way, Brother Juniper is burned at the stake as a heretic, he and his book, that he's trying to compile about these five.
Wow.
So you can't know some of these things, and the best resolve is just to love the people in your life now, not knowing when they will go or why they will go, but they're here now and you should love them. These people are here now and you should love them. So, let me just check our time here, cause I feel like I'm going, yeah, okay, we're right about where, you know, where I knew it would probably land, but not where I aimed. But anyway, so, overall, I told you already, I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10. It's a more melancholy of a book, but decently worth your time. I feel like a 7 through a 10 is a very premium rating. So I don't think it's quite up there. Like I just looked at the other titles in that category. I don't think I'd put it up there yet. But I want to come back to that thought about the lack of precision. So like, as I was reading it, and it's like, we're talking about life and death and these characters. And I wish you just plainly tell me what you're trying to say. And as Josh kind of hinted at earlier, I kind of came to the discovery or the conclusion that maybe Wilder is doing that intentionally. That the whole point of the book is that you can't know things that are mysterious for a reason. That if you try to empirically study the ways of God, you're just going to be confounded all of your life. The point of what's true about God is not to empirically prove things. The point is to trust him. And so I think that's kind of the point, is the ways of God are mystery. And so I have a quote here from James Sire. You simply don't know what you don't know unless the one who knows what you don't know tells you. And that's kind of like this Brother Juniper studying the lives of these people, trying to find out a thing that he doesn't know. And at the end, you kind of are reflecting on the fact that he still doesn't know, even though he thinks he knows. And much better just to trust that the ways of God are mystery and know that God does have a plan and a purpose and death and suffering, but you might not have all the answers. So anyway. Talk for a long time about that. Any thoughts?
I found it very fascinating. It sounds like a book almost even on biblical epistemology. So the study of knowledge and what we can and can't know, and just even evaluating life. So yeah, I found it fascinating. Thanks for sharing it.
Yeah, I would say it's fascinating as well that as readers, I've not read the book, but as a reader, I would imagine you kind of find yourself kind of a little bit like Father Juniper, and you're wondering, you're trying to figure out in the same way that he is, what's the rational explanation for why these particular people died? And then you realize at the end that that kind of thinking gets you burned at the stake. And so
yeah,
as a reader, it's actually teaching you how to think about these things as well.
Yeah.
I think what occurred to me at the very end there was, so often we do try to figure out these things, and God hasn't told us. And the quote, you don't know unless someone tells you. And if he hasn't told you, you should trust. If he did tell us with greater precision all these details, it just occurred to me a temptation would be that I don't need to trust him because I know these things. And so in his mercy and wisdom, he doesn't tell us everything. And then we can actually learn to trust him. And yeah. One day we'll know everything, but then we would know more in the eternal state, but we would have developed true trust in him. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
And interesting little thought there.
Right before the final meditation, I'll cap it with this. So this is set in the early 1700s. And throughout the scope of history, you have the Spanish Inquisition that's happening in the 15 and 1600s that extends to their territories, which would be Peru. It's like the Viceroy of Spain. And they mention the Inquisition the whole time. And it's through the inquisitive Inquisition where people look into Brother Juniper. They deem him a heretic and they kill him. So what is the Inquisition? Like what are these decisions being done? It's a group of people deciding who gets to live and who gets to die.
Oh, that's good.
And then you go back to that first chapter with Brother Juniper, and all these people are thinking about life and death, but there's only one person that did something about it. And in my experience with death, you kind of get to a point where you're like, well, what do I do here? And Brother Juniper's response was, answer all the questions. Like, I have all these questions. Let's answer them all empirically, scientifically, which at that time frame, 1700s, was also taking place in the world.
Well, I was just thinking the Scientific Revolution, the Enlightenment, and modern turn. Like, so we're going to tabulate everything. We're going to have hard science reliability. And so that kept coming up in my mind.
In this character, you have the modern thinking of rationalism approaching a very age-old question. Why do certain people die when they die? And at the end of the book, you get that scene where he's been trying to apply his reasoning to a theological question. And what does he do? He gazes up at the beauty of the sky. He rips up his papers and throws it, which is like a hopeless scene. Like, I can't figure this out. So like, you can know that you don't know something and be hopeless because you don't know the one that knows. But then he gets deemed a heretic. He's going to get burned at the stake. And here he is being martyred. You know, and obviously he's probably not orthodox in any sense of the word, but he's smiling and content in his own death. Why? Because he's like, you know what? This is what God's plan is for me. And so he abandons reason and trusts, and he, you might even say, enjoys his death. And so it's a really interesting journey with those characters. And so you start off reading about that mom and you're like, what is this? And it's like, it's kind of veiled too in some like language barrier, like the names are Spanish, you don't know how to pronounce them. And like, you're reading people's letters and they're talking about, and you're like, what? Like the initial hurdle was just so cumbersome. But then, as I mentioned at the onset, the characters draw you in and you kind of grow an attachment to one of them. And then you start growing an attachment to a couple of them. And then their deaths start to affect you. And then you get to the end of that book and you're like, well, why did they die? And you're like, oh, well, we don't know. And so was it God's mercy that kills Esteban, who wanted to die anyway? Was it God's judgment on Esteban for trying to kill himself? What about the two innocent children who are just bystanders in the story? Is it God's mercy to them to take them out of a suffering situation? What about Uncle Pio, who's a really kind of dastardly guy? Is it a judgment call? But at the end, he has compassion over a child and wants to help him. So like, is it a redemptive death or is it a judgmental death? In the end of the day, you're like, you're just confounding yourself uselessly. Why don't you just trust that God knows what he's doing? And you know, so it strikes a very deep human chord when you get to the end of it. But I actually don't know. I think I mentioned this way, way early on. This whole thing was kind of inspired to Thornton Wilder by this passage in Luke 13. So I think probably just it is the best fitting end would just be to meditate on Luke 13.
So we'll have a meditation now on Luke 13, but I want to ask a question first.
Yep.
Does it say that in the introduction or did you find that elsewhere? Or how did you know that this was
a source? I had to do some subsidiary study. So my first read through, I wasn't really sure what I was looking at. And then I just started doing some research on Thornton Wilder, and pretty commonly, as you start reading about the Bridge of San Luis Rey, it's commonly noted that it's this story in Luke 13, which is the falling of a tower that kills 18 people that Jesus kind of mentions. It was that scene that kind of painted to him this, like, you know, he recreates that scenario. Like, instead of 18, it's five. Okay. Instead of a tower, it's a bridge. But so a lot of the sources I was looking at reference this passage in his, like, this is where it came from. And it's not, I'll just say it's the verses you're going to talk about. It's not verses that little kids memorize on Wednesday night.
No, this is not those kinds of verses.
It's like, I had to like double take and be like, that's in there. Like, I didn't even remember the comment that was there. So anyway.
So what I'll do is I'll read through Luke 13 verses 1-9, and then I'll have some comments to annotate as we go through it. And so Charlie had shared enough about this book that I knew approximately what was coming. So as I studied this, I can see a ton of parallels. This is rich. So I'm going to go ahead and read 13 verse 1. At that time, some people came and reported to him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. I'm going to read the whole passage, then I'll come back and make comment. And he responded to them. This is Jesus speaking now. Do you think that these Galileans were more sinful than all the other Galileans because they died in this way or they suffered these things? No, I tell you. But unless you repent, you will all perish as well. Or consider those 18 that the Tower of Siloam fell on and killed. Do you think they were more sinful than all the other people who live in Jerusalem? No, I tell you, but unless you repent, you will all perish as well. Verse 6. And he told them this parable. A man had a fig tree that was planted in his vineyard. He came looking for fruit on it and found none. He told the vineyard worker, listen, for 3 years I have come looking for fruit on this fig tree and haven't found any. Cut it down. Why should it even waste the soil? But he replied to him, sir, leave it this year also until I dig around it and fertilize it. Perhaps it will produce fruit next year, but if not, you can cut it down. So the parable does directly relate to the statements Jesus made about what was going on. And so what's really interesting here is this passage has a current events feel. So Jesus is responding to a current event that had happened because of Pilate's actions. And in the response to it, it's revealing a typical Israelite or Jewish way of thinking about suffering. So generally the Jews believed that suffering was an indicator of great sin. And you can even go back to, which is surprising me, because if you go back to the book of Job, the whole book eviscerates that line of thinking. You cannot look at suffering and say that person absolutely sinned. So what literally came to my mind was recently there has been the fires out in California. And so there's a scene of Mel Gibson's talking to Owen Brand, and he leans over and he's like, my house is burning down. And it's in Malibu. It's like happening right then. And he's somewhere else at a conference. And so some people on Facebook and social media who have been Christians have said, God is judging Hollywood. And so then thankfully the counter for many Christians is, well, how do you know that? How do you have some sort of a way of knowing for sure that's what it is? And essentially they're saying, if God hasn't directly told us that, we can't really know that. So as I'm thinking through this, and I'm thinking through what you said, like the parallels are everywhere. So the first portion of this passage is essentially asking this question, does suffering indicate great sin? And so what had happened with these Galileans in the temple worship, and this is from a commentary, but Tim, if there's something you need to adjust here, dive in. No, just, I know you're familiar with it. This is like a field. When the Galileans would come to worship in the temple, they were allowed to slaughter the sacrifice, but they were not allowed to pour the blood on the altar. That had to be the job of the priest. And so it wouldn't be uncommon for a Galilean believer to be there and doing that. Well, apparently Pilate had walked in at some point while Galileans were doing this, and he mixed their blood with their sacrifice, which means he slaughtered them. And so their blood's mixing with the blood that they were about to put on the altar. And so it's a particularly horrid way to die. And as you research Pilate, he was actually really harsh toward the Jews, and he had done lots of like these sorts of things. So when this happened, the people around asked Jesus, they're sort of talking, I would assume. I'm assuming something. They're talking about this, saying, man, they must have done something. And so it sounds like it sounds like the people in the story who are like, hey, they must have sinned. And so Jesus says, do you think that these Galileans were more sinful than other Galileans because they suffered these things? So when Jesus asks that, he's reducing their comment to the, like, to their, well, not really absurd, but to their ignorant point of view. They can't know that. How can you know that? You can't know. And so he says these things, and he says, no, I'm telling you, unless you repent, all of you are going to perish. So in that sense, Jesus says, do you see that event that just happened and those people died? And he's essentially going back to what it says in the garden. Death is the result of sin, and sinners are going to die. Are you a sinner? Unless you repent, you're going to perish just like this. Now, I think everyone's going to physically die, but he might be blending the two, spiritual death and physical death. And then he gives another story, which is like a current event thing, because there was this tower in Siloam that fell and killed a bunch of people. And Jesus refers to that, which everyone would have known about. And he says, do you think they were more sinful? And I can imagine that in the culture, these Jews must have been saying, oh man, those were sinners. This one guy, I think he was sleeping with someone, and that lady, she wasn't doing this. And I'm imagining that. I don't know if that's true, but I would imagine that. And then he says, he repeats word for word. He's like, no, I tell you, but unless you repent, you'll all perish as well. So just from that first one, first section of this passage, I would take some admonitions from Jesus, and this might be good for you, listener, and for me. When people die, it's hard to think about. It's sad. It's sorrowful. And sometimes when bad things happen, especially leading to death, we can tend to think, yep, they sinned. They should have died. But I think what Jesus wants you to do is turn that question back on yourself. How have you lived, and what do you merit with your actions and behaviors? And so I remember talking to Dr. Newman, and sometimes you go through a trial and you don't know why, and you can't connect it to anything you've done, but God uses it to bring some other sin in your heart that you weren't aware of. You can't connect those two things, but I think there's a good principle that when you face suffering, it's always good to look internally. Do I have unconfessed sins? Am I loving the Lord God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength? Not because that suffering is directly related, but possibly it's something you need to use to grow. Now, Jesus goes on and tells a parable, and I think this one starts to take aim at a specific group of people, and that would be Israel. He tells the parable that this man had a fig tree, and he's the fig owner. He's the vineyard owner or whatever. And he comes and looks for fruit, and he's waited 3 years for fruit. Now, there's no significance to that as far as I understand when I was studying. It's just a sufficient amount of time to test if this thing's going to be fruitful. And after 3 years, seeing no fruit, he realizes this is just wasting time. And so he says, let's cut it down. Now the vineyard worker says, no. Let me dig around it and fertilize it, and let's see if it produces fruit. So the commentators here were saying that was probably Israel. And so Israel hasn't been producing fruit, and it's time to be cut down. And then there's this worker who's like, hold on, let me try one more time. So think about the irony. Here's Israel, who deserves to be cut down because they're not producing fruit. And then the Israelites are asking, hey, why'd those people die? They must have been bad sinners. And so Jesus is, I think, trying to get Israelites to think, man, you guys are sinning. You should be considering this too. So I feel like I could end this, but do you want to jump in, since this is your content, and tie any of this together or say anything? Because I think the admonition is, do you need to repent?
Yeah, I think what's the very last line of the book? Because what I think is fun is, here's a award-winning author 100 years ago thinking about the exact same things that we're thinking about today. Like, if Thornton Wilder was at the table, I think he would be in love with the conversation we're having and looking at Luke 13. But the very last line, like, but the bridge between the land of the living and the land of the dead is love. And like, what is the one thing that fulfills all the law? What's the one thing to do, you know, to God and to your neighbor that fulfills every commandment? Is to love. And here are these people in the wake of death. And the question is not, were they really big sinners and that's why they died? The question is, you know, okay, I'm still living. Am I going to live the life I should? And so you have a very strong admonition from Jesus, like, you're thinking about the wrong thing. You should repent. And then, you know, perhaps the people that have never given fruit will someday bear fruit. And that, at first, I didn't think the fig story had anything to do with the tower, but then I started thinking about it. and you look at the characters in the story, and they're three people that you thought they're never going to change. They're never going to change. And on the cusp of death, what did each one of them do? They repented. Now, it's not the repentance of faith and turning to Christ that we would, you know, exalt, want to, had to happen for people. But here's this mom who is just idolatrously loving her daughter and just wants all the control, and finally comes to this point of like, you know what? I'm an idiot. I shouldn't live my life this way. And then the, you know, the guy who's at a point of despair to taking his own life has a resolve of like, no, life is valuable and I'm going to go live it. And then the third character who's lived his whole life just manipulating and controlling and orbiting in this like kind of sinful, low stage area of life. And he finally has compassion genuinely for another person to help them. Like, I'm going to take this little boy and I'm going to raise him. I'm going to educate him. I'm going to give him what nobody else can give him. And so at the end of their life, they're the unfruitful fig trees, and they bear fruit, and then they die. And you're like, wait, at first you're like, yeah, these people deserve it. And then you kind of turn the page and you're like, if only they could have lived longer, because they just started bearing the fruit.
Do you think that's Brother Juniper too?
That's a great question.
Because he kind of has a change of thought at the end, and then exactly. He dies.
Yep. And here's the narrator kind of viewing it all, kind of painting that picture for you. And it's like, okay, so what's really valuable in this life? Do you point at the other person and be like, yeah, you know, if the tower fell, I'd want them to die. Or is it like, you know what? Maybe tomorrow they'll bear fruit. And maybe I can bear fruit right now. And so that's where I think, you know, putting the book with Luke 13 and thinking about it is really good.
So I think we can see there's three possible responses to suffering. The first is to look at the people suffering and look for their sin to see why they are suffering. I think the second, which isn't mentioned here, but many people do it, is to look at God and say, how dare you let us suffer? But I think what Jesus wants us to do is to humble ourselves and look at our lives and say, we don't know why this is happening, but do I have somewhere that I need to repent? Because according to Jesus, we all deserve punishment. So maybe bust out Luke 13 later today or sometime this week, spend some time thinking about it, and look in particular. Is there anywhere that God might use this passage, even if it seems disconnected, to show you where you need to turn and repent and follow him? Thanks for listening. We'll see you on next week's episode.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.